Welcome to IT Chapter 15, IT 1, Semester 2, Chapter 15. It's Elise Lonsdale and Grace again. Now, Grace has got commitments where she's going to have to leave early and has asked me to do the lecture. Rather than that happening, I've invited Jackie, who's one of our newest trainers, to come in and present the lecture with some assistance. Probably not necessary to have any assistance because she's pretty good. And we were sitting down and planning the notes out. So basically, this is Jackie's debut of training a lecture, of presenting a lecture. It is a bit tricky, this lecture, in the respect that we weren't really comfortable with the order of the notes. So whilst we encourage you to read your notes, you might find that we're going to present it in a slightly different order. And that is basically because we've had a lot of experience in setting these networks up, in the physical life, and as such, we tend to do things a little bit differently from the way we saw the notes laid out. So, without any further ado, may I please make welcome Dr. J.
Oh yeah, that is my nickname, you guys. Can y'all hear me? Is my audio okay?
Yep.
You're good.
You're fine.
You're good, Jackie. Good. Excellent, thank you. And I just want to say welcome to everybody, and that would include any Indian and Sri Lankan students that might be listening to this, and I hope everybody enjoys themselves. We're going to start out tonight on section 15.4, installing the network. And the first thing that I would, the notes have it right about this, have a checklist. Have a plan. No matter what you're doing, I think it's really advisable to have a plan. Can anybody figure out why you might want a checklist? Anybody?
So you don't miss anything when you're going through it?
Yeah, really.
To have a record of what you've already done?
I was going to add a comment here.
Yeah, you've done something for sure.
Has anybody ever seen where you go and buy a new piece of furniture from the office supply store? And there are two camps. One makes a plan and reads the instructions and lays it all out. And the other one ends up tearing everything out of the box, attempting to put it together, failing, screaming, and then having a family meltdown. Don't know whether anybody's ever seen that. But that would be my reason why you would have a plan.
Well, exactly. So you want to make sure that all parts are in. That's the first thing, that you have all the parts that you need. I mean, Murphy's Law, and it says that inevitably if you need N parts, you're going to have N minus 1. And so I always tend to, like if I'm going to install a router or something, and I have DSL, so I need phone filters, you know what? I tend to ask for an extra or two. Because you know what? It's easy to forget about the phone out in the garage. Oh, out of sight, out of mind, you know, that's my excuse for everything these days. But anyway, make sure you have all the parts, and you know what, it never hurts to bring along a spare or two. Make sure that you have a time that you've agreed upon, that both parties have agreed upon, that you're going to come out and install the stuff. Do not just show up on a person's doorstep and go, I'm here, I'm going to install your stuff now. They might be right in the middle of a family meltdown or a family get-together or something, and they might not want you to be there and install the stuff right now. Make sure that the computer has been backed up. You know, this may not sound like something that would be necessary to just go in and pop the case and put in a network interface card or something like that. You would be surprised at the havoc that can go wrong, you know, in doing something like that. You know what? 99 times out of 100, it probably isn't necessary. But, you know, I didn't think that I would have a problem when I was trying to make a person's computer a little bit more blind-friendly by just altering the display settings. Until I found out afterwards that the person's Windows was not installed on the C drive, and the thing absolutely came tumbling down, and Windows was in a crashed heap. So it's always good to have a backup. Make sure
backup
you...
Oh, okay, there we go. Is that if you open that case, anytime you open a case, no matter what, you are exposing it to electrostatic discharge, so you might have a problem with one of the components not working or something frying, and then you want to have that backup.
That's absolutely correct, especially if that component happens to be the hard drive.
That's the point. because you're not getting it back unless you've got another hard drive.
No, but the it's next thing, possible. Yeah, it can happen.
Okay.
Or just because, you know, I mean, look, just because you opened the case and because the hard drive is 12 years old and it picked that time to die, I mean, you might not have done anything.
Yes.
But you can sure get blamed, believe me. So it's always best to have a backup. Make sure you have access to needed information such as the username, password, etc. to log on to Windows, and also, since you were going to be installing a network, to configure the network properly. You're going to need that information. Make sure you have it before you get started, because if you don't and you can't configure it and you're right in the middle of an installation, it is not going to go well. Extra supplies. Well, we kind of talked about that. And, you know, make sure you have your tools, you know, all the tools that you need and stuff. It is not a good idea to show up at a customer site and go, do y'all have a Phillips screwdriver? It doesn't make you look too good. Okay, so once you have your checklist ready, you can start installing your components. The first thing that you'll probably want to do is install a network interface card if those aren't already available. And let's just assume here, and you know what you do when you do that, that they aren't. The first thing you'll want to do is make sure that the network interface cards that you have are compatible with the computer. It is not a good idea to go ahead and buy, for example, PCI Express cards for a machine that only accommodates PCI cards. They ain't going to fit. And, you know, it's not going to look too cool if you were the one especially who helped the customer pick out the equipment. Now, if you didn't and they bought the equipment and you open it up and figure out it's not going to fit, then... oh, well, although it would have been, well, sometimes you can't really, you know, make that determination until you get out there and have a look at it. But the other thing that you want to make sure of is that, like if you have wireless, that the standards are compatible. Like one of the test questions, you know, you have three wireless standards, basically. There's A, and there's B, and there's G, and then there's a draft standard called N.
That's never been right.
N's out of draft. Out of draft.
Oh, it's out of draft now?
Mm-hmm.
Ah,
right.
When did
N
that
is,
happen?
Three months ago.
Because the last I saw it was in draft. Sorry, guys.
That's all right.
But anyway, the B, the G, and the N... In other words, the N tends to be to support backward compatibility. But, for example, A is on a completely different frequency and not compatible at all with any of these other standards. So if you get a bunch of A adapters, and, for example, a wireless N access point, you're in a lot of trouble. So you've got to make sure that the equipment is compatible. Does anybody have any questions on that? Okay, so once you've got the network interface cards in, the next thing to do is to install your access point or your router. Now, in the home arena, or the SOHO arena, the small home office arena, basically, the kind of device that you're going to get for this usually is what they call an ISR, integrated service router. And that tends to include a router, a modem, and often a switch. It's all integrated into one little box. And I think I'm going to talk about installation of it from that vantage point. But do understand that you may encounter separate devices, such as a router and a modem that are separate. And the installation is going to be different for all of those. So I'm not going to talk about very much about the physical installation of the equipment, because obviously this is going to vary. You do need to connect the outbound to the internet port, whatever that's going to be it cable or be it a phone jack for DSL. And you do need to connect a computer to the router, and that's usually, or the ISR, and that's usually done via a RJ45, you know, a LAN connection. Does anybody have questions about that? Am I talking over your head, or do you know what I'm saying here? Assuming that everybody's with that. Okay.
This is where I say silence is golden.
Exactly. At this point, what you'll want to do then is power up the router, power up your computer, and go into your web browser, whatever your default web browser is, and enter in the IP address of the router. Now, hopefully you will have determined that by means of the documentation that came with the router. By the way, and I should have said this earlier, make sure that if you have to install things like phone filters for DSL, that you've done that prior to plugging in your router. Things don't work well.
Can I just interject here for a sec?
Yeah.
It gets back to the phone in the garage. Maybe you've heard the story. I just couldn't get this thing to sync up to a known ADSL connection. The ADSL connection was there working with another modem. And it occurred to me, and it's only because I know this person well, being a friend of mine, she was up in the bush. She had, in the typical bushy, she had a phone in the garage. And that's what did it. And if I hadn't thought to ask her whether that was there, we wouldn't have been able to filter it, or more accurately, cut it off the line. So yeah, part of it goes back to your research. Make sure you're aware of what other bits and pieces that your customer might have around their little office that they haven't told you about.
Just another point too, filters go round a certain way. The line is on one side and the phone is on the other. If it's a filter splitter, you have a line, a phone point, and a modem point. If you get it wrong, it won't work. And you can tell by listening to the phone that's plugged into it whether you can hear ADSL line noise and that sort of stuff. That's not my lecture, so I'm not going to talk about it. But make sure that you do have the right things plugged into the right holes, and that people can figure out which holes are for which connections, and that the cables run where you think they do.
Yeah, precisely. So at that point, you're going to want to configure your, we assume now, and you know what you do when you do that again, that the any filters have been installed, that they're installed properly, folks. That it does bear repeating. You've got to do these things right, and you've got to be meticulous and attentive to your details. Or you could be in a very tight situation. So your next thing is you want to configure your router. In my case, what I would do would be that I would open up my web browser, and in my address bar or wherever, I would type http://192.168.0.1 and go into the router. Now, the addresses vary, and you do have to make this determination by means of the documentation that comes with the device. But what that is an IP address, and at that point you can enter whatever settings need to occur, and they should have been given to the customer by the internet service provider. The username, the password, any other information that you may wish to enter. Specifically, if you are installing a wireless network, you may want to change the SSID, the default SSID or service set identifier. The reason for that is because default SSIDs and passwords and stuff like that can very easily be hacked into. You'll want to secure it. I would never advise you to install a wireless network without securing it. It's just the proper thing to do. So,
One of our ex-students actually gets his internet by stealing the neighbor's wireless. So, ruin his day. And any other people who might be thinking of doing this, lock them down, because people will take a free resource.
And what if you have a bandwidth cap?
Well, that's exactly it. Not only what if you have a bandwidth cap, which you guys, you know, in Australia and everything do, but here and sometimes we in America do too. But the other thing of it is, all kinds of, you know, information can be gleaned from an unsecured connection. It's just a bad idea.
I have a story about this.
Go for it.
Okay. So I heard of somebody, a friend of a friend.
But lean towards your mic a little bit.
Okay, is that better?
Probably a bit too better, but anyway.
Okay, there you go. A friend of a friend got a letter from the ISP saying there was illegal download activity on their wireless network. Now, this person was an older person and wasn't doing anything illegal, and they were really curious as to why they would get this letter. And they found out it was because somebody had been accessing their wireless network and doing some file sharing on their behalf. So that's another very good reason to secure it.
And most of the internet service providers' terms of service, which of course not many of us have read, but some of us have because we thought we should, say that you are responsible for anything that occurs on your connection, whether it was you or not, and you signed that document. So the ISP is going to come back on you, not the illegal file sharer.
Believe me, I had situations where... my son-in-law was doing file sharing over my network, and I ended up losing my internet connection for a while because evidently he got a little beastie on his computer and turned, you know, started.
I think it was a Trojan zombie, that did it basically. In that time, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, does anybody have any questions about that sequence of events so far?
Makes sense so far.
At this point. Oh, good, Mark. At this point, what we'll want to do is start to test our connectivity. Okay? There's several ways that we can do that. The first thing that we can do is fire up the web browser and go into the address bar and type www.google.com. And if it goes according to plan, you're connected to Google. If it doesn't go according to plan, however, there are some things that we can do to make sure that things are as they should be. So here are some connectivity tests. Okay, the first thing that we can run is a ping. And Carrie, what's your favorite expression?
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Or if it breaks, you keep both pieces. If you don't get that ping. Although I'm just going to point out very quickly that sadly the Windows XP firewall, which is on by default, and the Windows Vista firewall and the Windows 7 firewall, which is on by default, thank you Microsoft, gives you a few more headaches before you realize what's going on.
That's true, although you know what? I've never had any trouble with being able to ping out, even with the Windows firewall being on.
No, you can ping out. You just can't ping the actual boxes themselves. You're right. You can ping the ISP. You can ping the router. You can ping everything else. You just can't ping the actual workstations. And usually I do a ping test on the workstations before I bring up the external connectivity because I'm just a bit superstitious like that even.
Oh, okay.
Like we said, the right notes are a bit out of order.
That's all right. No. I'm just saying that's what I do. I'm not saying that that's even in the notes, at least. I'm just saying that's I make sure the internal connectivity is working before I even bring the router online as far as the internet's concerned, but that's just how I do it.
Cool. So ping is a command line utility. I'm sure you all have dealt with command line utilities a little bit. Basically, there's a lot of ways to get to it. You can do start programs, accessories, command prompt. I tend to like to hit start and run and type CMD and press enter. And when I get to the command prompt, then I can type ping followed by a space and followed by either an IP address like 192.168.0.1 or a host address such as google.com and press enter. And at that point, you get some messages, and it either says it connected, or it says it timed out, or it sent X number of packets that were received, or an X number of packets that weren't. Now, be advised that some websites do not accept pings. This does not mean that there is a problem with your connectivity. It means that the particular website in question does not accept a ping. Having said that, you should be able to ping your default gateway or your router. If you cannot, we have a problem. Houston or Melbourne or Madison or Long Island or wherever you happen to be located. Another command that we can use is the traceroute command or tracert command. It's, in Windows, it's T-R-A-C-E-R-T. And what this does is, again, it works similar to ping. They use the same protocol, the ICMP protocol. But what happens here is that it actually traces the route that the connection takes from start or from source to destination. And I would encourage you guys to actually, you know, do these things on the command line and see what it looks like, because it's pretty interesting. The first line that you get is the gateway, and after that is the various hops or network hops that it takes in order to get to the connection or to the website that you have specified. The next command that you can use on the command line is ipconfig. And the ipconfig gives you certain information like your default gateway, what your particular IP address is, who your DHCP server is, which is Dynamic Host Control Protocol server. It gives a whole bunch of information and can be very helpful when troubleshooting network connectivity. Does anybody have any questions about that so far? Is anybody awake so far?
We are.
Sure.
Is everybody bored?
No. You're doing a fantastic
Nobody
job.
Nobody wants to incriminate themselves. Right.
No, I'd tell you if I was. Seriously. And I'd expect you to tell me.
Sure. I'm sure you would, Gary.
He probably doesn't snore.
Well, he might, but if he doesn't, if he's not pressing down on his control button, no one would ever know.
It's happened. Okay. In fact, I fell asleep last week in one of the lectures, but that's okay. We'll move on.
Whoops. All right. Assuming there are no questions, and I haven't heard any when I stop. So those are some ways to test connectivity. Now, the next aspect perhaps to cover a little bit is home networking. Why would you want a home network? Well, it's very simple. If I need something off my husband's computer and he's in the other room sleeping because he works nights and sleeps days and I don't, if I go in there and wake him up, I am one dead person. Or at least I am going to wish very seriously that I had not gone in and woke him up, truly. However, if what I need is in his shared documents folder and his computer is on, I can just go in and access it, and there we go. Anybody else can think of any other reasons why you might want a home network? There are others. I can name a few, but I'm going to let you.
You can access other devices such as printers or fax machines or whatever might be hooked up to another computer.
Precisely, Mark.
And there's something else that we all like to share too.
Yes.
Music.
Come on, guys. Yeah,
exactly.
Music's fun. But no, I was thinking else. What else do we want to share between multiple computers in the home or the small office? That's not a printer.
It's really obvious. I know what it is.
Let's see if the class can get it.
Guys, this is really obvious. What do you want to share
Come on,
in
guys,
your house?
This is easy.
So easy. Or do you want the rest of... I'm not even going to give you a hint. Anyone come up with it?
At the moment, my brain is asleep, apparently.
All right, Mark, come on.
Email, messages, whatever.
Well, sort of, but it's a global word, and it's big.
Starts with the ninth letter of the alphabet.
Yeah.
How about your internet
You're talking
connection?
About the internet.
You want to share the internet! Yay! Oh, boy.
Yay!
Which includes the services that Bob mentioned, the services being your email and your whatever, websites. But yes, you need to share out the internet, because if you have a family that doesn't have the internet shared out to each and every computer in their house, you will have a right.
Or you will have a computer that everybody is, trying to access, and most of the time at the same time, and that's called a riot. So, good. All right? Any other reasons why a home network might be advisable? Okay, so one of the things that we have to do then is to make sure that if you want to have a home network, then we have to get that connected up. Now,
excuse me.
Yeah.
I have just one very small question. In my experience with trying to hook up a home network, the internet. That is pretty much a default setting, isn't it? Like, it automatically should, if you get your home network set up correctly, it should automatically hook up to the internet on all your computers.
No. You've actually made some purchasing decisions that have allowed that to happen. And in fact, one of our students who has had this problem, and I'll dob her in, she lives in Queensland, we won't say who she is, she actually had a single port router, and one of her computers could access the internet at a time, and that is what her internet service provider provided to her when she signed up. And she had to actually change the router to allow multiple computers to access the internet. So in America, they tend to give you a 4-port router, perhaps, or an 8-port router, or whatever they're going to give you. But sometimes if you're really cutting costs and stuff, you might end up with a single port router. And no, not every computer will get on the internet automatically.
I assume you're referring to me, Kerry.
I am, Leon. But you had that problem. You had a single port router, and one machine would go on the internet, and that was unfortunately a bit of a limitation for you. No sitting in that easy chair with the laptop.
No, true. I finally got the problem resolved after about 7 months.
Okay, well, it doesn't normally take 7 months, but it does date back to something that Ananda and I were alluding to last week. If you've got friends and they're in this situation, offer to help them set up the home-based network, because that means every time you go over there, you can share it too.
Oh, I love it. Ulterior motives, guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Believe in me, I've done it.
One thing that you have to be aware of is that each computer that connects to the network has to share the same network group name, okay? And they have to have an unique name. So, for example, in my situation, if Carl and I are connected to a network, my computer has to have a different name than his. So mine is MIDI Mom and his is Carl McBride, not too original. But we have to share the same network group. Now, the default in XP is MS Home. And because I'm paranoid, I have a tendency to change these defaults. And so I came up with another network group name. But just be advised that you have to have the same network group in order to connect these computers. The next thing that...
Oop, mistype.
Yeah, work group. Exactly. Were you going to say something, Kerry?
I was just going to say I mistyped. Yeah, it's work group. In 95, 98, ME, and 2K, the default is Workgroup. Now, if you use the Network Setup Wizard to reconfigure one of those operating systems with the Network Setup Wizard disk, and yes, I have seen people do this, and yes, it does work, it will change it over for you. But if you don't, you've got to remember to change those workgroups over on those older operating systems. And yes, they're still out there. We still have people in Western Australia running Windows 95. What can I say? Money's tight, and people just haven't upgraded.
That's why they say it's called wait a while.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, and as I said, you know, I have a tendency to change these defaults because everybody knows what they are. I mean, you know, everybody
mine.
Knows what they are. Yeah. One of the other things is that with regard to a network, I don't know about you folks, but as much as I love my husband, there are some of my files that I would just prefer that he not see. And you know what? I would rather suspect that as much as he loves me, there are some files that he would prefer that I not see. Not that we're doing anything wrong. It's just that it has to do with our own private stuff. And there are ways to go about doing that, and the technical term for them is called permissions. And the kinds of permissions that you can have on a network is that you can either read or you can write or you can have full control. And you can actually set these permissions. First of all, you have to share a folder, and the way you do that is that you right-click the folder, or you press your applications key, and you'll go to like sharing and security, and it says share this folder, and you get to pick who you're going to share the folder with, and you can give some permissions also with regard to the folder, especially if you turn simple file sharing off in Windows XP. They don't like you to do that, but there are some reasons to do it. I would not advise that you do it, though, unless you really know what you're doing. Now, another thing that we can do on the network is to share a printer. Mark knows something about this because we did this one night. Basically, what you're going to want to do is on the printer that you want to share, you right-click it, and you have to make sure that file and printer sharing is on. That's one thing. Do make sure that file and printer sharing is installed. You can figure this out in Control Panel. If you go to Network Connections and Properties, you can determine network connection, the connection that you're looking at in Properties. You can determine whether file and printer sharing is on. If you turn it on, then Windows Firewall will let it through by the default behavior.
I think they've used the Windows Network Setup Wizard that does it too.
Yeah,
something that's one of the questions it asks you.
Yeah, that's probably true. And that's a nice feature also. It works well most of the time. So you need to set up file and printer sharing in order to do this. Okay. Again, to share a folder, you right-click it, specify sharing and security, and specify, you know, share it with the users of the network or whatever. The printer, you right-click it. You tell it you want to share it. And then the other computers will go to the control panel and printers and faxes and add printer and add that particular printer. Does anybody have any questions about that?
I actually am just sitting here thinking about, you know, when I mentioned that printer, my brother's computer wasn't, for some reason, allowing my printer to be hooked up to his computer. I still haven't figured that one out. I'm just chalking it up.
Yeah, the best thing to always do in the case of these is make sure your printer is known to work on the local computer first before you go sharing it out. If it doesn't print on the local computer, it's no good. So make sure you can do your test print page. You've got your printer configured on your brother's. If it's connected to your brother's computer, make sure it works on your brother's computer first, then share it out. Because there's nothing worse than trying to troubleshoot a network printer and only to find that the cable from the host machine to the printer's dropped out and you didn't know. Oh, the printer's faulty or something.
No, that wasn't...
Any other questions?
Well, that wasn't the problem, but we can talk about that off-channel.
Any other questions that we have? Is anybody awake?
Yep.
I was going to make a quick comment, too, about connecting to a network printer. If the computer is visible in my network... If the computer that the printer shared out on, or that the folder is shared out on, is visible in another computer's My Network Places... you can see that by going My Network Places and Windows Network, etc. Then you click on your work group or whatever the work group name is, and then you should see all the computers in that work group. You click on the machine of your choice, the one that's usually got the printer on it. You will see in the list in the folder view there, you'll see the list of shares, whether they be folders or printers. And often if you just double click on the printer, it will ask you, this is a network printer, and it will go and snaffle the driver off the other machine, and all being well, that is, should connect you. So it's just a little bit different from going around through a control panel.
So many roads lead to Rome. Isn't that a good thing?
Yes, and that's IT, the way we do it. Doesn't matter which way you do it, just as long as you pick the one that works for you.
Really? Another service that you can get, you know, from the network is email. Now, you can install email servers, and Elise and I kind of talked about this, and we really felt that we wanted to go lightly over this just because... most of you are not going to be installing Exchange.
It goes into Exchange.
Yeah. but I did want to talk a little bit about configuring up a client for email, because this is something that you folks will need to do. And I'm not going to talk about specifics simply because, you know, each program has a different way of doing it. But I am going to talk in terms of generalities, because there are certain things that simply apply to all programs. Okay.
Yep,
yeah, that was actually one of the things that I am going to cover now. Before we actually start talking about installation or configuration of an email client, we need to talk a little bit about a couple of protocols that are used by to send and receive email. Now, I think that protocols have been covered here before, and I think that we define the protocol basically as a set of rules used to communicate. Is that right? Is everybody familiar with the term protocol?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you. You know, I understand that I have been listening in on the lectures, but coming in kind of late is a little bit of a disadvantage for me, so I'm just wanting to make sure that you guys are familiar. The three protocols that we're going to deal with are POP, which stands for Post Office Protocol, IMAP, which stands for Internet Message Access Protocol, and SMTP, which is Simple Mail Transfer Protocol. Now, POP and IMAP are basically for... POP is basically for receiving protocol, receiving mail. And SMTP is for sending mail. POP usually... is configured to use port 110. And I say usually because when you're dealing with something like Gmail and stuff that's using secure protocols and that kind of thing, it's not 110. Like Gmail is 995 or something like that. SMTP is generally configured to use port 25, but again, this can vary for a variety of reasons. And IMAP is usually configured to use port 143. Now, I say this because this is information that you will need to configure up an email client, such as, for example, Outlook Express, Windows Mail, Windows Live Mail, whatever the new iterations of it, all these clients are, Thunderbird, Eudora, if I don't know.
Enjoy.
Bye, guys. Best of luck.
Okay, well, we're doing well with time, so keep going.
Okay. Yeah, maybe I'm doing too well with time, Elise.
I think you're doing absolutely fantastic, Jackie. I really do. I looked at my watch half an hour in, thinking we were an hour in, and I thought, good grief, we've covered a lot in half an hour. So it's all in the presentation, guys. If you ever want to become a lecturer, come talk to us next year. Anyway, beside the point, back to some IMAP and TCP, back to some POP and IMAP and SMTP protocols and ports. Go for it, Jackie.
Okay. Thank you, Elise. When you're configuring up a client, you have to have certain information. You have to have the account name. Usually that is the person's username. For example, in my case, since my email address is abletech@gmail.com, it might be abletech. It might be abletech@gmail.com. So you will need to consult the documentation for the particular email provider. What is the account name? Okay. The other thing you're going to need is the username. Again, this is usually the entire email address, such as abletech@gmail.com, but it may not be. It may be simply abletech. You will need, or it may be something else entirely, you will need, again, to refer to the documentation provided by the email service provider. This may be the person's internet, or it may be, you know, something such as a Yahoo Mail or a Hotmail or a Gmail type account.
Well, a lot of internet service providers in Australia, they tend to let you use their own, and they'll provide you one, if not more than one, email address. So you might be, say, on, say for example, like TPG. I could be EliseLonsdale@tpg.com.au. I could be EliseLon@tpg.com.au. I don't use them, but I could if I wanted to. I have my own mail server. So, yeah, you need to know what their rules are for connecting with the server, how they like the username to be specified, whether I want it just as the username or the username at domainname.com, etc.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to have your documentation. The other thing that you have to have is a password. Now, this is something that you usually tell the service provider, although sometimes they actually give that to you as well. But you have to have that. The other thing that you need is that you need designators for the POP and SMTP names, server names. So, for example, my POP is pop.gmail.com and my SMTP is smtp.gmail.com. But sometimes...
You're still going, are you?
We're still here for 20 minutes, guys, just letting you know, so we are listening,
sure.
We're lurking. And
oh, okay.
I have a point
well,
on...
we're not talking anything...
No. I've got a point on passwords when you finish this stuff on the servers that I want to drop in.
Okay. You need to have your server names, though, and that's real important, and you also need to have the port numbers that your SMTP and your IMAP and your... POP3 are being received on. And you need to enter all of this information into the email client. What were you going to say about passwords, Kerry?
I was just going to say there's actually a joke about a girl that had to have a password and I won't say what color her hair was because it's not important, and she had a password that had, you know, Mickey, Minnie, Daffy, Daphne, there was about four others, and Canberra. And when asked why she'd picked that password, she said, well, the administrator said that it had to have eight characters in it and one had to be a capital. But seriously, with passwords, know what they are. Write them down. For the love of the deity of your choice, please write them down. Put them somewhere safe. Because the little star, 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 star thing on your computer is not going to remember it forever. And one day, they're going to go. And I don't know how much time has been lost by people who desperately want to get back on the internet after a computer crash, but they can't remember their password. Just a little bit of forethought goes a long way.
But if you do write them down... Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, go.
Okay, so there's a woman that called tech support.
But lean into your mic.
Okay, there you go. Sorry, this mic just kind of moves, and it's like this weird flexible thing. Okay, there you go. All right, so there's this woman that called the tech support desk, and she said, I can't log in. And they said, well, how are you logging in? And they're like, well, I saw the other girl type in her password on the screen. And they're like, okay, so what are you typing in? She's like, oh, star, star, star. Isn't that it? So, yeah, write them down.
And the color of her hair wasn't important either, right?
Nope.
but it was the same as the eight character guy.
It probably actually is. And you know, it's a problem, okay, guys, because here's the thing. Okay. On the one hand, you do not want to get into a situation where you're using very simple passwords and the same passwords all the time, because that's a hacker's delight. You know, people love that. On the other hand, you got to have something that's memorable. And so there is a real delicate balance that occurs, and there is actually a program out there called KeePass. And it's spelled kind of weird. It is not KeyPass. It's KeePass. But anyway, that's designed to help with that.
Did you need to get that?
I'm ignoring it.
I was just going to... Kieran's got a story that he just shared with us briefly. He just wanted to quickly pass it on. Basically, they had this woman who worked at one of the TAFEs that he was working at, and she was complaining that she couldn't get on to the local resources, and she couldn't get on to the network, and she couldn't log into the network, and nothing she would do would log her into the network. And they ended up finding out that this woman was actually trying to connect to the Joondalup TAFE network, which is up in the northern suburbs of Perth, from somewhere in town, and she wasn't even on the campus. So there you go.
Are all these stories about women?
No, there are some pretty stupid blokes, but I think the guys just sort of get drunk and talk about it in the shed quietly. We don't tend to hear about them. I'm not inferring in any way or shape or form that the fairer sex makes more mistakes. We probably just threaten people, and they don't ever talk about the mistakes we make. That'd be my theory.
Look at some of the emails that you'll get about tech support problems, and a lot of them are males.
I work for a person... I worked for a person who was trying to set up her new email account and were asked for the POP3 name. She kept typing in POP3. I mean, the person.
You know, I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, things that occur like this. So just know the information that you need to know, okay? Or know where to get it, folks. I mean, if you need to, you know, if you need to go on the net to Gmail or Hotmail or... I didn't catch that. Or whatever, go get that. Does anybody have any questions about how to configure up an email client? Because this is something, ladies and gents, if you go into the computer technology field, you will undoubtedly have to do.
It was RTFM that got put into chat there. So it was just a bit quick with the TTS. I had to go back and catch it myself.
Read the fabulous man.
Exactly. So, does anybody have any questions now about installing and configuring and testing connectivity and that kind of thing?
I have a brief question. I tend to prefer cookbook-like instructions about this kind of stuff, and I haven't finished a chapter. Do we get those kind of notes?
No, and there's a good reason for it. The cookbook-like instructions should be provided by your ISP, and all ISPs are different. So we could give you a cookbook, but you might end up putting chili powder in instead of paprika when you get to a certain point. That's why we only provide guidelines. Well, that's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it.
And that is exactly the exact reason, Kerry. Yep.
Yeah, here's the problem.
Yeah, go ahead, Jackie.
Give me back DOS 5 any day.
Well, I agree
with
you.
Even in DOS 5, it varied.
Yeah, it did. I mean, the problem with a cookbook is, and this is sort of one of the things you find, if you're a really good cook, you don't need the cookbook as much because you can improvise and change the recipe. The cookbook gives you the framework. So when I think of giving people cookbook instructions, I'd like to give them guidelines on how to do it rather than a 2 cups of flour, 3 eggs, whatever else. I know it's nice to have a little thing that you can follow and you go along and you go step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, done. But what happens when it all goes wrong? What happens when step 4 fails? Or the bloke did something that stopped step 5 dead in its tracks? And that's what this course is trying to teach you, how to get yourself off those train tracks and to be able to sort yourself out so that you're not stuck on the cookbook of follow, you know, slot A, tab B. Where's tab B? I don't have a tab B. Oh, well, I'm done. Might as well give up now. Because the problem with people, not you specifically, Bob, but the people, generally people who follow cookbook instructions, is once the steps stop working, they give up. And they just stop dead. And that's what we want to discourage, because there's often a solution for a problem that if you can find it. And that's what this course is all about, as far as I reckon, anyway.
Well, look, Kerry's exactly right.
The other thing of it is, I happen to do a lot of cooking. And I have a maxim, as it were. I follow a recipe once, and then I say, "Oh, well, I think it needs a little of this and a little of that and a little of the other thing," and from there on, I deviate. I use the recipe as a guideline to see what I can use.
But I find the redundancy of windows a real problem, because if you can do this 1, 2, 3, 4 different ways, as long as those 4 ways work with all 4 of the next possible steps, you're okay. But I find that's not true. I find that you have to have a proper sequence of particular redundant facts to make windows work, which I think stinks.
Look, Bob, if you're after cookbooks, when it comes to ISPs, I'll connect you, because that's what we're doing. We're connecting our mail client here, so we better keep it on context of our mail client being connected to our email server, whether it be with the ISP or anywhere else. If you're after cookbook-like instructions, often some of the more pricier internet service providers will actually have them. And they're set up for all the dummies, I guess you could say, because the dummies don't know as much as we do, and it'll probably have pretty little dialogue boxes, and in this dialogue box you type this, and in the next one you type that, and sometimes you may, as a technician, feel more comfortable using some of those more expensive ISPs because you know it's going to work. So it depends on, we do try and in this course encourage people to know what they're doing rather than learn it by rote, because if, as Kerry said, if step 4 gets broken by some unexpected thing and hams over step 5, then you do need a little bit of nous to know how to get around it.
And
let me give you a couple examples. The guy that set up our server didn't put a password on it. Everybody comes in and says, "What's a password?" There isn't. My wife has a different, she's a brunette, by the way. My wife has a different password and username for every account, and she didn't write them down.
Then you need KeePass.
Yes, ma'am, I've got to get it. Thanks. I'm sorry, I'm getting this offline. I just find it pretty frustrating, and pardon me. Back to you, Jackie.
Well, and you know, I mean, obviously, the person who did not put a password on a server, in my opinion, did not do their job. Because that left it open for you or me or anyone else who decided that they wanted to get onto it. And God help anybody if there was confidential information on that server. You know, folks, I mean, I don't know if people realize this or not, but there are people that go around doing network vulnerability scans to see if they can tap into people's networks to get confidential information off of those networks. Do you folks understand that, you know, it used to be, folks, that people who wrote viruses and stuff like that were just programmers seeing what kind of havoc they could create or trouble that they could get into. Nowadays, ladies and gents, it is organized crime. They are after information about you and about me in order to steal our stuff, our identity, our money, our bank account, whatever it is, folks, our name, our credit, they are after information about us. And it is imperative that we do what we can to secure things up. And anybody who does not put a password on a server, I'm sorry, that is just criminal. Does anybody disagree with that assertion?
I have a little comment about that.
How'd that person ever get to be chief systems operator at a medical center?
Okay, you may not have heard each other.
How does that same person work for Social Security and the FBI?
Well, they weren't acting too bright that day, I'll tell you.
Yes, ma'am. No question.
Maybe their boss wasn't looking. Go ahead, Mark. You tried to mic up to say something.
Okay, my comment here is as we're talking about hackers and viruses and all that good stuff, I go back to my mom had to cancel one of her credit cards because she never puts her credit card number out on the internet. She's just, no, not going to happen. Because somebody decided that they were going to use her credit card number in France somewhere, all these charges, and she got the bill and she's like, I never went to France. I never bought these things.
we had the same thing. Jackie and I did a security audit on a friend of mine's computer a couple of weeks ago here in just outside of Melbourne, and we thought originally that that's where she had a flight booked for $900 on her credit card in England. Now, this friend of mine's never been to England and would have, at this point in her life, no reason to be booking flights out of England for $900. So we had to go through and find out, and we declared the computer free and safe. We did everything we could to, and that's another issue, security, we won't do in that today. But, sometimes a credit card can be pinched or even just guessed, and we automatically think it's our computers, and in this instance it wasn't. So it is unfortunately uncommon that these criminals are up to all sorts of things.
Actually, a lot of these are inside jobs, but the fact of the matter is that we have to keep our computers safe, and one of the ways to do that is password protection. Okay, the next topic, I think, once we've talked about, you know, the network being up and stuff, is preventative maintenance. I'm sure everybody has heard the saying that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and never more is it truer than in a computer/network situation. The best way to avoid trouble is to not have any, seriously. So one thing that you can do to help to prevent problems is that as you're going around to the various workstations, that if you need to, you know, if you do that or whatever, is to just look at your cables and make sure that they're attached properly, that there's no breaks, that the cables are labeled, and that the labels are legible, and that they're not coming off, etc. If they are, then, you know, those need to be reattached, relabeled, whatever it is. Make sure that cables are not in areas that they can be stepped on or, you know, tripped over or whatever. Try to keep them out of the way. Keep them from breaking. Make sure that there is no tactile or visual evidence of, you know, loose connections or whatever to indicate that, you know, sometimes you can see nicks in the cable or whatever that indicates that they're trying to break. So if you hear the equipment making weird noises or see, for example, that it appears that the lights on the router are, you know, like flashing all the time or whatever, indicating like constant activity or whatever. These are things that need to be noted and examined in order to prevent breakdown of the equipment. And I really do think that preventative maintenance is one of the most important things that a computer technician can be engaged in. Does anybody have any questions about that? Lastly, we're going to talk about the troubleshooting process. You folks have been apprised of the troubleshooting steps, right? Wherein, you know, you get information from the customer and you look at the obvious issues and you try to find quick solutions. And if those don't work, you get information from the computer and then you resolve the problem and you close with the customer. You're all familiar with that sequence, right? In networking, you have to do a couple of extra things because you're not just dealing with a standalone computer anymore. This is connected to a network. And so you have to determine what the source of the problem is. Is this only with one user? If so, then you're going to want to start looking at that particular user's computer. That's the first place to start. If several users, like a particular work group, or the entire company is having a problem, then you know what? Looking at one user's computer probably is not going to be... Excuse me? Okay. Who typed that? I can't seem to find that in the chat window.
I think we've got somebody... Yeah, I can't tell. Somebody's left the channel, and I think I'm on a bit of latency.
Okay. At any rate, as I said, if you're going to if the whole group of users or the whole company is having a problem, looking at a single user computer is probably not going to be of assistance. Especially as long as it's not a bus connection or something, which undoubtedly these days it usually isn't. So. Obviously, in a situation such as a networking troubleshooting problem, the problem can be a result of hardware, software, or connectivity issues, or combination of those three. Troubleshooting a network situation is a more difficult thing to do than is a standalone PC. But obviously, the tests of connectivity that I gave you earlier and those kinds of things will help you along in this process. Does anybody have any questions about this stuff? Are you all bored or what?
Can we go back to the connectivity test?
Of course. What you need, Bob?
Well, I can't picture it in my mind. I'm looking for syntax. CMD colon PING is CMD colon tracert. Is that and then enter?
Okay.
That how you do?
Okay. Let me give you some syntax. Okay. When you type start and run and CMD and press enter, what you get is the command prompt, and usually what it will say is /documents and settings, your username. Or it might say /Windows /System32. Depending on how your machine is configured. Again, here's the thing, Bob, about cookbook instructions. It used to be in DOS and to a lesser extent, but still pretty much in Windows 95, the things were all configured the same way. They didn't really have user profiles and that kind of thing. But now in Windows XP and Vista and now Windows 7, there's a lot of room and variation. So I'm just going to say that what you will get is a /documents and settings for XP now, your username. And it's followed by a greater than prompt, usually. But this can vary. What you would do then, it would be to type ping, followed by a space, followed by either an IP address or a web address. So, for example, I would type run, start, run, CMD, press enter, and I would type ping, space, 192.168.0.1, and I would get my router. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, yes. I guess what I was looking for, rather than cookbook syntax, is what I'm looking for is the greater than symbol indicating where I should type.
And it is there. You will see that greater than symbol followed by the cursor, and you can start typing your ping or your trassert command or your IP config after that.
Okie doke. That's what I needed. Thanks.
It looks like a typical, and I hate to use the word DOS prompt, but yeah.
It's really what it is. It's a prompt.
Yeah, I'm used to seeing C:\ and waiting, but I didn't know. It's been so long since I worked with any of that stuff that I thought maybe there was something specific to look for. When we go back to the command prompt, we're not actually going back into DOS. We're still in Windows.
Yeah, what you've got to remember, Bob, is that this is a DOS box running over the top of Windows, so it's going to be subjected to whatever Windows wants it to be subjected to. And basically, you'll probably, as you mentioned DOS 5 earlier, you'll be very familiar with C:\. You end up in whatever directory Windows wants you to end up in, and in this instance, in the instance that Jackie's talking about, it's usually C:\documents and settings, and in my case, /release, greater than.
Okay. You're not in DOS. You're not in DOS. Let me clarify this for you, Bob, because it's an important distinction to make. What you are in is a command prompt, or a Windows command prompt, or more technically correct would be called the console, the Windows console. And the difference between that and DOS is that DOS is what's called real mode, and it's 16-bit. Windows here, we're dealing with protected mode and 32-bit. Now, I can explain those distinctions, but the truth is that it used to be that Windows 95, Windows 98, and to a lesser extent, Windows ME was actually built on top of DOS. Windows XP, no more. In fact, the file systems, you know, the FAT file system that DOS used to use has now been replaced by default on XP with the NTFS file system. And you can have FAT32 on Windows XP. I'm not saying that, but I am saying that by default the file systems are different, and you've gone from 16 to 32-bit, and now 64-bit in certain circumstances, most circumstances. And you've gone from what's called real mode, where only one program can really operate in the memory space at a time, to protected mode, wherein programs operate in their own memory spaces and are supposedly protected from others, so that if one program goes rogue, the whole thing doesn't come tumbling down. We all know that does not happen. Does that clarify for you?
Yeah, very much so. Thanks. Thanks to Elise and thanks, Jackie.
Any other questions? Because these are important, and this is what we are here for.
How are you going out there with it all, Amanda? We haven't heard from you for a while. Oh, silence is golden. We keep going for the recording people. Evidently, everyone's coping well.
Yeah, I actually think we're ready to do the quiz, shall we?
I think we almost might be ready to finish up, yep.
Anybody have any questions before we get the quiz?
We only have 3 students on.
Let her rip.
Shall we do it a little?
We shall. You ready?
Yep. Shall I do it or should you?
No, you can do it. It's your lecture. So if there's no other questions, yep, Jackie, go for the quiz. So now's your time, guys. If there's anything, we'll throw it open for general discussion after the quiz, like usual. But if there's anyone's got questions now, please let's have them. No comments. Okay, Jackie, hit it.
All right, is everybody ready to answer question one? Which protocol is useful on networks with low security requirements? Which protocol is fast and useful on networks which have low security requirements? And here are your answers. A is AppleTalk. B is HTTP. C is IPX/SPX. And D is NetBUI. Answers now. Again, the question is, which protocol is fast and useful on networks with low security requirements? A, AppleTalk. B, HTTP. C, IPX/SPX, and D, NetBUI. I'm looking for one more answer. I believe I got a B and a D. I guess we have an abstention. The answer is D is in Delta NetBUI, okay? The second question is, which hazard exists when working with copper cabling? A, chemical. B, copper strand. C, glass splint. D, light. Yeah, precisely. B is correct. Okay. Number three.
I was just going to say these questions are the ones that were mentioned in Grace's half of the lecture, which was, of course, last week. So you might have to think back a bit,
right,
folks. As is the next question, question three, was also one that Grace talked about last week as well. So you can remember that. Go ahead, Jackie.
Which internet connection is best in rural areas but can be affected by weather? It's a high-speed internet connection. It's usually used in rural area and can be affected by weather. A is cable. B is DSL. C, ISDN. And D, satellite.
Well, excellent. For some reason I can't...
You're having a problem with chat, are you, Bob?
Yeah, I think the answer was obvious. I left and came back. I'm in the... Forget it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you need to be in the edit field at the bottom of that window. Make sure you've alt-tab tool because it's showing that you're in chat. Well, if you have too many problems, just sing out the answer. Bob will let you off this time because if you're having difficulty.
And if you need help, Bob, let one of us know and we can work with you and see if we can't troubleshoot your difficulty. Okay, four. Which network device can regenerate the data signal without segmenting the network? Move, Magic Mouth. The answers are A hub, a modem, which is B, C is switch, and D is router. Again, the question is, which network device can regenerate the data signal without segmenting the network? And the answers are hub, modem, switch, and router.
Want to have a go, Bob?
Want to have a go? I think he may have left. Okay,
Don't worry, you can just say your answer, Bob, if you've got problems. You don't want to fight with it while you're trying to do a quiz. Go ahead, Jackie.
No, I'm here. I just can't type in the edit box.
Okay, well, tell us what your answer is.
D.
All right, let me try and explain this question to you, because I think it's a problem that we're not understanding what's being asked.
We didn't cover it very well anyway, so
yeah.
Go ahead.
When they say segmenting the network, what they actually mean is making two or more different networks, okay? Would you agree with that, Elise?
When I stop chewing on my Vegemite sandwich, yes, I would.
Sorry, I didn't mean to catch you that way. Okay.
Didn't catch me having a bite.
So,
sorry.
So, what we have here is we have a device that all it is designed to do is boost the signal. That's all it's designed to do. It does not split the network into two or more different networks. Okay? Now, a router, if you have more than one router... You're right.
Yep, that's fine, Amanda.
It would
right.
be.
It's okay to get them wrong, by the way, guys. Because it does exactly what's happened here. It prompts the discussion, which has led Jackie into saying what she's doing.
Right. If you have more than one router, a router can actually be a splitting point for a network. You actually do divide networks up using a router. You don't with a modem, because a modem is just a device that, well, it stands for modulator demodulator, and so it's actually connecting to like a phone line, that kind of thing, or a cable line, to get usually to go on the internet or perhaps a network.
Connect to a point of presence that may be in an exchange
exactly.
or an internet service provider. Or
exactly.
another, we used to use modems to connect across the phone networks to computers, but this was when bulletin boards and things were all the rage a long time ago.
Exactly. But it always did connect to a bulletin, a computer that was a bulletin board or whatever. But it does not regenerate the signal. A switch, a switch does regenerate a signal, that's for sure, but it
makes decisions as to where packets should go.
Yeah, it makes decisions as to where it's going to go.
If you come to a CCNA course with us next year, guys, you'll learn why these
exactly.
different components exist.
I mean, I'm just trying to explain this to him in terms that you'll notice I'm stuttering a little bit, and I'm going, oh my gosh, how do I explain this to him in terms that,
in terms that makes sense. You need to have a little bit of bridge knowledge here. That's why I put in the plug for the discovery course.
Exactly.
You learn why, but essentially I can see why Jackie's stuttering is because we've got to find the way that will make sense to people here in the ITE course.
But basically what a hub does is it boosts the signal and it passes it on. Okay? A switch can actually decide, you know what, this signal will go here but not here. A hub passes it on no matter what. Because a switch can actually direct traffic, it's more like a little traffic cop there, it doesn't need to boost the signal because all it needs to do is pass it on to where it's headed next. Does that make any sense to anybody? I think everybody's left, actually.
Robert, hang on, let's check it for you.
I'm still here, Jackie.
Okay. We've still got Amanda. We've got Amanda, we've
oh,
got
good.
Robert
right.
has come back, I think he prematurely left, and
we've
always got
Leon too.
We've got
right.
some students here.
Number five is a network technician has been asked to install network cabling in a new building, which important task must be completed as part of the installation. I can't talk tonight.
Yep.
A, label at least one of every cable. B, cordon off the area and allow only two people in. C, run all cabling using only one person to avoid confusion. Label both ends of the cable to identify each cable. Yeah, D is right. All right. 6, which path is used to access the wireless networking connection using Windows? And the first one is Start Control Panel Administrative Tools Network Devices. And then B is Start Control Panel and Network Connection. And then C is Start Control Panel Network Devices. And then D is Start Control Panel Hardware and Network Connections.
What was the question again?
The question, Bob, is which path is used to access the wireless network connection in Windows XP?
Apart from being clever like most people and stick a shortcut to it on the desktop.
And again, the answers are A, Start Control Panel Administrative Tools Network Device, B, Start Control Panel Network Connection, C, Start Control Panel Network Devices, And D, start control panel, hardware, and network connections.
I can help out here if you like. The answer you're looking for is actually B, guys. Start control panel, network connections. Or if you've got the old menu on, of course, start settings, control panel, network connections. So it depends on, I guess, in that respect, as to which of the two choices of Windows start menu in XP you have.
Which protocols can you use to receive email is question 7. And there's two answers here. So we'll probably do a yes or a no. The first is DHCP. Is this a protocol used to receive email? B is SNMP. C is IMAP. And D is POP3. And E is SSH.
Yeah, this is the question I think everyone's going to love. It did come up earlier.
All right. What we have is a company who got a bunch of wireless NICS at a great price. Once they tried to connect to the wireless 802.11n wireless network, they found out they couldn't. What is a likely cause of the problem? One is that the wireless adapters are designed for the 802.11a standard, not the N. B is that they're designed for the 802.11b standard. C is that they're designed for the 802.11g standard. And D is they're designed for the 802.11n standard, but via USB.
Get some more answers, folks.
Any more?
Are my answers coming through? This thing's pinging again.
Yep, you got your answer through there, Bob, and you were correct.
The answer is A, folks. Remember that we went over tonight, actually, I talked about this, that the 802.11a standard was actually on the 5GHz frequency, whereas the other 802 standards were on the 2GHb frequency.
2.4 gigs, I think.
Say again?
I think it's
2.4G. Yeah, it is. And the thing...
people who want the acronyms? Abbreviations,
right.
Rather, sorry?
GHC. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm saying GHZ, and you guys say GHZ, huh? I apologize.
We do.
Well,
the majority of people
all
aren't
right, so I'm
American,
saying so Z, and she's saying Z, and it's all good. Obviously, 5GHZ and or Z and 2.4GHZ or Z are two very different frequencies. So what these folks got was they and by the way, 5GHZ or Z is pretty non-standard. They don't use a lot of that. There's more of it used in Europe than anywhere else, but even then it's not common. So these folks picked up and to have an access point that for a 802.11a wireless access point is pretty expensive. So yeah, they got what they paid for, didn't they?
Yeah, I'm just
does anybody have any comments? Oh, I'm sorry, what, Elise?
I just love that question because it said here they got them at a great price. Little wonder they wanted to offload some 802.11a junk.
Precisely.
There you go. What's he going to say?
It happens, too.
You say tomato, I say tomato. We had both when we stayed in Perth with my American friends. It was good.
It was. go ahead.
The answer to 7 was POP3 and IMAP, right?
That is correct.
Correct, Amun. Does anybody have any questions about this material so far? Well, Elise, it looks like we finished on time and under budget.
We finished quarter of an hour earlier, and that was well done. Well done, Jackie. Join me in congratulating Jackie on her first full lecture. So that's great. Well done. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Jackie.
Yeah, thanks, Jack.
All right, we'll be back to do it all again next week with security, I think it is, for chapter 16, which will be the last chapter of IT1. There's a number of worksheets for both 15 and 16. I know some have been submitted by students, so that's a fantastic job for those who have put those in, so it's all good. So we'll see you all again next week for 16. We'll also have a week just before Christmas, so we might, I haven't looked at it yet, but we'll probably split chapter 16 over the next 2 weeks. And if anyone's got any questions, please don't hesitate to bring them up, because if we do split it, we'll have a bit of time for revision. I'll sit down and work through whether we do more revision or not. But if you've got questions, please bring them. Don't be embarrassed to ask them in front of the audience, because you never know. You just could be provoking the discussion into something that somebody else thought, oh, I wouldn't mind knowing the answer to that, but I didn't want to be caught asking, you know what I mean? So no question is a silly question, and you'll all be coming up to your finals, so you want to make sure that you read through all the notes, listen to all the lectures, even go right back to chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., and sort of have a bit of a revision before you do your exam. But job well done, everybody, to get this far. You've all done very, very well.
Agreed. You're to be commended.
So I'm going to stop recording now, and we'll see you all again next week.
Bye, y'all. Blessings.
I'm off for lunch.
All right, Leanne, talk to you later, Bob, and Amanda, because I'm off too. I'll come up and grab you on Skype if you like, Jackie, and have a bit of a debrief. So I'll catch you all later.
Later.